start with 2563.
But it's Star and Lindsay.
Hey, my doctor's headed, well, not all the way over to your part of the state, but okay. They're going to Brussels for their...
House Committee on Revenue will please come to order. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2563.
I'm praying for the teachers.
2563.
Thank you. We don't have a quorum
yet. Yeah, we do.
We have five.
One, two, three, four, five. Yes, we do have a quorum. Yeah. Now we have six.
Now we have six.
Okay.
Please.
Okay. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, House Bill 2563, you have before you the -5 amendment, which it just includes the extension of the sunset for a food processing equipment exemption. It moves it from July 1st, 2011, to July 1st, 2013, so through the 2011-13 biennium. The exemption is estimated to have a revenue loss of $2 million and a shift of $400,000, and the fiscal impact is found to be minimal.
Okay, and this is a property tax measure, is that right?
Correct. It exempts the manufacturing equipment for food some food processing so that it's the property taxes on that equipment.
Okay. And this is the gutting stuff?
Correct.
Okay. And do we know what counties it's most likely to have effect in? Representative Berger?
Counties with food processing, with major food processing activities, such as Marion County.
Right. That's what I thought. Representative Berger?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I would move the -5 amendments to House Bill 2563.
Representative Berger moves the -5 amendments to House Bill 2563. Is there discussion? Any objection to the -5s?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for coming in a little bit late. So we are moving in the -5s, which removes
the bill
provision on alternative energy systems.
Yes, that is correct.
Right. Just while you're raising that issue, there are difficulties with the alternative system, energy system amendments. We haven't been able to get them back. We're getting very late in the session, and we thought we'd do the part we could do.
And further, in conversation with the proponents, they have indicated that maybe next session, in the interim, they would have time to work through some of the issues around this, which are difficult.
Technical.
And so time being short, we are proposing that the piece that is ready be moved, and the piece, and if the other piece should get ready in the time that of this session, we will find a vehicle to move it. But at this time, it's not ready.
Well, yes, please.
Thank you. Just a comment to say that I appreciate those comments. I understand we are getting late in the session. We need to move things forward. It is my sincere hope that we work very hard in the interim to find a solution for alternative energy devices. This is a situation in which these devices, especially when they're on churches, when they're on schools, when they're on public property, ought to have some of the similar benefits of those properties. And I think that it's very important that we examine how we can continue to promote alternative energy in this state, and I hope that we will continue to work very hard on this.
Thank you, Representative Bailey. Representative Bailey, for what it's worth, I completely agree with this, with your statement. Any further discussion on the -5? Any objection to the -5 amendment? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2563 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves 2563 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? I think we've actually had it. Okay. Is there any objection to the motion?
Yeah.
No objections. It's so ordered. Do you want to carry that one?
I would be happy to carry
Representative
it. Thank you very much.
Berger will carry. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2563. And open a work session on House Bill 3606.
We're looking at -6.
We're looking at -6.
6.
Chris.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3606 in front of you. The relevant amendment is the Dash 6 amendment. And with that amendment, the bill makes a number of technical corrections and clarifications following up on House Bill 3680 from the 2010 session. Going through the Dash 6, this deals with the business energy tax credit, and it clarifies that the first year that a transferee may claim the tax credit is the year in which the transferee pays for the credit. And it also moves the transfer language of that credit from Chapter 315 to Chapter 469. The reason for that is just dealing with the rules issue. The Department of Revenue has rulemaking authority for Chapter 315, and the Department of Energy has rulemaking authority for 469. And since Energy administers the credit, it makes more sense to have that transfer language in the chapter in which they have rulemaking authority. It also provides that the total, rather than the certified cost of a project, is reduced by any federal grant amount. As you know, the Betsy has been around for 30 years or so, and it has always, and Energy has administered the credit in that manner until a recent AG opinion. And as of April 18, 2011, they were moving to subtracting the grant from a certified amount. This basically switches it back to the way that it has been administered for a number of years. It also clarifies that applicants are eligible to participate in the tax credit program as well as a low-interest government-sponsored loan program. And it clarifies that renewable projects with a certified cost of at least $10 million, an application for final certification shall be considered complete with the identification of a transferee. This pertains to the so-called six-year Betsy. In 2010, that was one of the changes you made for these large renewable projects. The five-year period would start the year after final certification. There was a technical glitch in that that aging process was not starting for these large projects, and it had to do with the definition of a final certification needing the identification of a transferee. But the transferees, when they would come in to buy a credit, they could either look at the six-year credit that they could buy this year and not claim until the next year, or they could buy the five-year credit. And so then there would never be an incentive to buy the six-year credit. So the intent in 3680 from 2010 was to, for these specific projects, the large renewables, to allow that aging to begin so that the final certification would be considered complete a year prior to the identification transferee. So that just clarifies that language. So all of the pieces are a clarification of 3680 and the intent of 3680, and all of the revenue impact. This bill has no revenue impact because all of the revenue impacts related to House Bill 3680 are already in the current law, economic and revenue forecast. And you do have a fiscal statement. It's just a light statement because the bill is moving down to, or is scheduled to move down to tax credits.
Right.
That would be up to tax credit.
Well, I think down to this is the right way to say it. But because after all, this is a joint committee, so it's moving closer and closer to the lower house. But what that does mean, colleagues, is that we'll get another look at this bill in the other committee. Representative Bailey, did you want to speak on this one or make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd move the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 3606.
Representative Bailey moves the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 3606. Is there any other discussion? I don't see any. Is there any opposition to the motion? I don't see any, so the motion carries. Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move House Bill 3606 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Representative Bailey moves House Bill 3606 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. Any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? If not, the motion carries. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3606, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 443. Mazin. Alex, do you want to come up, too, while he's talking? Please.
Yes, Chevron Hart, members of the committee, Senate Bill 443 comes to you from your counterpart on the Senate side, and it passed. And the Senate Bill 443 is a simple bill in its concept. It allows in 2007. Part of the law was injected in order to allow a couple counties, Douglas County and Lane County, to use some of their federal forest money that traditionally splits between schools and transportation projects on 25-75% basis to some of that money that goes to the transportation segment to be used for policing roads and policing the highways. And that measure at that time was to sunset on January 2nd, 2014. This bill basically extends that sunset by 2 years to the year 2016.
Thank you. Senator Przanski.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs, Madam Co-Chair, and committee members. Floyd Przanski, State Senator, District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. As your learned counsel has stated, this bill actually would extend an existing bill that was passed in 2007. Representative Morgan at the time and myself brought the bill forward at the request. She was bringing it at the request of Douglas County, myself, for Lane County and Douglas County. This was an opportunity in those days when we found ourselves in a somewhat of dire straits of trying to make certain we had public safety, a component for transportation and on the highways of the counties to be covered. And those two counties, the county commissioners, and wanted to move forward with the option and flexibility to use a portion of the money that goes for the road funds to be used for patrolling. That bill has been in existence since 2007, or I should say the law, and because of it, it has definitely shown how it can and does work effectively. The original bill, SB 443, was submitted to remove the sunset because both of the counties have found a way to work within their own structures to provide for the services that they need in maintaining roads, but at the same time, public safety on those roads. They found that the flexibility gave them much more comfort as to how they could, in fact, accomplish those goals for the residents of each of their counties. We have never had a position of opposition to allow any other counties to go forward and making the same modifications to allow their county commissioners to do so. I will tell you, historically, in 2007, when the bill was coming forward, we heard from some of the counties stating that they did not want to have that authority because they could see the political infighting that could occur. What I would say is that when you look at what has been the result for Lane and Douglas County, that has not occurred. It has actually worked well for the sheriffs as well as for the county commissioners to be able to make certain that they have coverage on these highways in the dire strait times. So if there are other counties who wanted to move forward and add their names to this, we have never had any opposition to that and still do not have any opposition to that. I guess lastly, what I would state and ask for you to consider is this is something that is what we consider a local control issue. It has been shown and demonstrated that these two counties have been able to use this with flexibility, and I would ask you as state elected officials not to micromanage the counties. In this particular case, we have two counties that are back here seeking to have it extended. We acknowledge that it will be only for an additional 2 years, but we would appreciate that. Lastly, I can tell you that the members that I've spoken to that represent Lane and Douglas County are in full support, including the two co-speakers, Representative Freeman, who was here briefly but had to leave, and numerous representatives and senators that represent Lane County as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Alex?
Thank you. Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I've submitted a written piece of testimony, and I wanted you to be aware this is one of the highest priorities for the Lane County Board of Commissioners due to the situation that Senator Brzezinski has given you an outline of in that it has provided for a degree of flexibility that the county has valued. And I'll point to that in this particular time, we're in the exact same position we were in June of 2007 when this bill was initially passed, and that is we're facing the elimination of the Secure Rural Schools Act funding. And so you've probably seen this table before. I've been using it quite a bit in testimony this session. The table on the document shows how this ramp down under Secure Rural Schools is working for us and the significance of the dollars. And I'd like to point to the three columns on the right of that table, and you'll see ONC revenue and then the two columns for United States Forest Service revenue. In Lane County and Douglas County, we're the top two recipients of these dollars in the entire United States, and over 50% of our land base is managed under the authority of the U.S. Department of Agriculture for the Forest Service and U.S. Department of Interior for the BLM or ONC lands. The ONC revenue, completely discretionary. So those dollars are already supporting public safety operations in the two counties. The U.S. Forest Service dollars go under the 1908 Act that I've outlined in a piece that I prepared and distributed to most of you yesterday, that in 1908, when the United States Forest Service was established, the Congress gave authority to the legislatures, as they deem fit, to provide 25% of dollars from timber revenue from the United States Forest Service to county schools and county roads as the legislature deemed fit. So essentially what we're asking here is that you deem fit that the county road dollars go to support the patrol on those roads. And you can see that the road fund dollars are declining, but we've transferred under the auspices of the Lane County Budget Committee and in great cooperation between the Sheriff's Office and the Public Works Director, starting in 07-08, about $1.2 million to support patrol, and for this coming fiscal year, about $3 million to support sheriff patrol. And again, under the auspices of the local budget committee. The entirety, this amounts, that transfer amounts to about 10% of the patrol services division's budget in Lane County. So it's an important piece of these dollars to support public safety. And I'll note sort of the nexus between the patrolling of county roads. We've got about 1,400 miles of county roads in Lane County, slightly greater in Douglas County. They're a slightly larger county. But remember, with that kind of ownership, our sheriff's patrols are on United States Forest Service land and roads and on BLM land and roads. So we do patrol these roads. The nexus for us is clear between the dollars that are provided and the services we provide, and we'd ask for this flexibility to continue. Again, as we're facing the elimination of this act, we've got to have as much flexibility as possible over the next several years. We're working very hard with our United States Congress and indeed across the nation, because SRS hits counties across the nation. We're really trying hard to get this act reauthorized, but it's a difficult environment in Washington, D.C., as you can well imagine. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Brzezinski or the county? Don't see any. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on Senate Bill 443? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 443 and open a work session on Senate Bill 443. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Move Senate Bill 443A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bailey moves Senate Bill 443 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Berger.
Yes, Mr. Chair. In bringing this forward, I understand the counties involved want this kind of flexibility, and I understand In most cases, I have been a proponent of flexibility for local government. In this case, the embedded policy I have objected to, and I have been on record of objecting to, which is that the federal government gives this money for roads, and we spend it on something other than roads when roads are a desperate need within this state. I also don't object to sort of the carve-out nature of some choosing winners and losers above among the counties. And I understand that the proponents would welcome other counties in. Other counties find this a very controversial issue, and the very fact that they have to go to the state to get authorization speaks to how tricky this whole thing is. That being said, I understand that there's no objection within the counties, and that it's, I think, the will of the legislature to move this forward, but I will be voting no.
Thank you, Representative Berger. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment to say that I hope this is a continuing step in the direction of allowing counties like my county more flexibility in how they raise funds and manage their own finances.
Well said. Let me simply note, on behalf of Lane County, I think, which is a considerable portion of my district is in the rural part of Lane County, that Sheriff's Patrol in Lane County has always been a difficult proposition. And I would say that rural Lane County is not particularly well served simply because of the lack of resources in dealing with the criminal investigation and other aspects that the sheriff is responsible for in the rural part of the county. I would also note that as compared to the Sheriff's Patrol, the road fund is relatively well funded in Lane County. It's not great, but it's not as bad as the Sheriff's Patrol function, because they have dedicated funds that come from that are especially earmarked, including some, of course, from this fund. That being the case, I think it's appropriate to give these two counties the flexibility that they've asked for in order to allocate the funds, and which is the reason why I was willing and interested in bringing the bill forward, and of course why we heard from Senator Przonski, who represents big rural areas in both counties, in favor of it. Other discussion? I think we better call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
Gelcher.
Aye.
Representative Green.
Aye.
Representative
Wan. Excused.
Representative Bailey.
Aye.
Representative Brewer.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barnhart.
Aye.
No.
Thank you. The vote is 6-1, and motion carries, and the bill will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I think probably I should carry that. Anyone else want to? Barnhart will carry. Close the work session on Senate Bill 443. Open a work session, a public hearing on Senate Bill 863.
Is that yours, too?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Mazin.
Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 863 comes to you from your counterpart on Senate side, and basically it allows for the electric companies in Oregon to assess a level of payment for the users in order to be able to raise a certain amount of money. In this case, about $50 million a year for the coming 2 years. And these are assessments that are based on the meeting of 2 out of 4 conditions. Most of them are either economic measures and poverty measures. As you see in the revenue impact statement, I've stated those 4 conditions that 2 of them have to be met. The money will go to the Oregon Low Income Energy Assistance Program, and from how the things look at this time, we believe that 2 of these conditions will be met in the coming biennium, and thus
getting about $10 million for the utility charge. And that's your bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kotek.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Barnhart and Berger, members of the committee. Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, here in support of Senate Bill 863A this morning. Always nice to see you all so bright and early. I will be brief. I have testimony. I won't read it. But let me just highlight why this bill is important. As co-chair, one of the co-chairs of the Human Services Subcommittee in Ways and Means, we're making a lot of cuts to very important safety net programs. And one of the things that we rely on heavily for the federal government to help us out with is energy assistance. As we see resources from the federal government shrinking, and yet the economy is not recovering as quickly as we would like, we have a lot of households in the state who are making choices between purchasing food or paying their utilities or paying for a very needed prescription they might need. What I like about this bill is that it's a coalition bill. It's a consensus bill. You'll hear from folks from the Northwest Energy Coalition here in a moment about why, how they've crafted this bill. So we like to see people coming together for solutions. It's also very well crafted. It's targeted. It has triggers. The details are there in my testimony. I'm sure you'll hear about. This is not something that will go on indefinitely. It's to respond to the current economic downturn. And we really have an opportunity here to help a system that functions well now. It doesn't create a new system. The resources go into the existing energy assistance programs that are run by community action agencies and counties around the state, targeting the families who need it most. So I hope we can move this quickly and get those additional resources into the system when we need it most. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Kotek? Thank you very much for being here this morning. We also have Scott Bolton, Marion Haynes, good morning.
Good morning. Co-chairs, committee members, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Corp. Pacific Corp serves Oregon as Pacific Power, about 570,000 customers, primarily in rural portions of the state. So we're Oregon's largest rural power provider, serving counties, you know, as diverse as Wallawa, Crook, Lynn, Josephine, just to give you some scope as to the customers and the communities that we serve. We support Senate Bill 863A largely because of the rural nature of our customer base. It's also some of the hardest hit economically parts of our state, so we're seeing a need out there. 863 supplements existing programs for a temporary period, for a two-year period based on the conditions that were just enumerated. And we believe that this is much needed backfill for what we anticipate to be significant reductions in the federal LIHEAP program. So we're seeing a high degree of need and a low degree of resource coming into Oregon. 863 and low-income programs are efficient. They're an efficient way for a relatively small cost to make sure that more customers can continue receiving uninterrupted service. This is important not just for those customers, but it's also important for the rest of our customer base because it's, as I said, it's an efficient way to make sure that we're not having other customers incur costs because of disconnects, because of bad debt being passed through to other customers, and making sure that we're keeping fixed cost spread as far as we can. And finally, one of the reasons that we think low-income assistance programs, such as what 863 is supplementing, work is because they're discrete. Customers who need help will work with their utility when they get into a problem. We can help those customers effectively, usually right over the phone. Sometimes we have to send a meter person to the customer's premises, but usually there's that one-on-one interaction to make sure that when a customer is in trouble, when they need help, we're able to provide that help right there and do so in a way that you know, is a private, discreet conversation among customers. And really, this is a customers helping customers bill. This will have no impact on the rates of small or large businesses in the state. This really keeps these dollars in the communities that they're being raised for the customers that most need it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, chairs, members of the committee. My name is Marion Haynes. I represent Portland General Electric. We serve about 820,000 customers, largely in the northern Willamette Valley. I'll try not to be too repetitive with what you've already heard, but PGE also supports Senate Bill 863. In this economic climate, we have seen a substantial increase in need, more shutoff notices going out. This program really is about crisis intervention. It deals with folks that are about to get their power shut off. And so I would echo what my colleague, Mr. Bolton, said about the efficiency of the way these programs work. All the costs associated with shutting off power, reconnects, bad debt write-off, collection costs would all ultimately be borne by the customers. And we view this as a way to get some of those dollars in a good system that we have right now for energy assistance and avoid some of those things. We've seen studies on other energy assistance programs that show that being able to do this helps keep customers paying their bills, and that's a good thing for the utility, for those customers, and for all of our ratepayers. So with that, we support Senate Bill 863. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a strict instruction here not to close this laptop, so I will try to adhere to that. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Fisher. I'm here on behalf of the Community Action Partnership of Oregon. This is an association that represents the 18 community action agencies statewide that serve all 36 counties. We're also here in support of Senate Bill 863. We administer the Oregon Energy Assistance Program, and we've seen a growing need for this assistance in both rural and urban counties. In 1 week in January of last year, we received over 56,000 calls for assistance statewide and had the resources to help about 9% of those folks. And as Representative Kotek mentioned, these are folks who are having to make choices between paying rent, buying food, or paying their utility bill. One in five of the over 100,000 folks that we were able to help this past year with the different energy assistance programs that we have, it was the first time that they were seeking any sort of public assistance. So we very much see this as being a part of the economy. The temporary nature of this bill helps to give a shot in the arm to these programs. So we thank our partners at PGE and PacifiCorp, as well as the Citizens Utility Board, for their collaboration on this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions? I have one. Do you have a sense that this may actually help keep people in their homes, this among other things that we do to try to help people who are financially distressed?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, thank you for that question. Absolutely. A lot of times, you know, a lot of the folks who we're helping are renters, and if your power gets shut off, that is grounds for an eviction. And so once that happens, then a whole much more complicated series of events begin to occur for that family, which make it much more difficult for them to get stabilized. So this is a critical program to help keep folks in their homes.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, let's assume for a moment the existence of absolute need. Why is it that the ratepayers pay and not the taxpayers? Why this narrow group being selected to help?
Representative Bentz, I think, you know, these programs aren't new. They exist all over the nation, and I think because the business model makes a lot of sense when you have rate-regulated utilities, or even for PUDs and co-ops, any utility system where you have a large population served under one utility system, it does make sense to be able to build these programs into the rate base of that, or into the rates of the utility, to be able to distribute help within that collection of customers. You could raise taxpayer dollars to backfill these programs, but it becomes very complicated to administer as you disperse general funds into different utility systems who may have different policies and procedures in place for how they would even interact with their customers and assess need. In our experience, this has been a good way to do it. I do understand the argument that, you know, it makes sense to have these programs be voluntary, and certainly there are some supplemental charitable programs out there that do help with different types of programs. Oregon Heat is one example. But certainly the preponderance of low-income assistance programs are those that are generally administered within utility systems and overseen by utility regulators.
Yes, please. Uh-huh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we assume the let's not assume anything. Let me ask: does the reference to there being an amount saved by virtue of this program by the company is interesting? I'm just curious how well it compares to the amount that's being collected. Do we have any figures that would suggest that the additional money we are collecting here has some relationship to the amount the company is saving or the ratepayers are saving?
Co-chairs, Representative Benz, we have found a study from 2003, so it's somewhat old data, but it does show that when you look at the cost-benefit ratio of these types of programs, that we're just about at a one-to-one level. The other thing that I would add to your previous question is there are taxpayer dollars that do help fund energy assistance programs. Those largely go to ongoing assistance that extremely low-income families need. A lot of the dollars that are raised through this utility program are targeted toward crisis intervention. Those folks that are about to have their electric shut off, that we would then definitely incur costs associated with those shutoffs, collection costs, bad debt write-off. And so in that particular instance, I think there's a real nexus between ratepayer funds and dealing with that crisis period that would result in costs that would flow through to the ratepayers.
Final question, if I may. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The focus of the company on who actually is entitled to the help. And I saw some language in here that suggested there was going to be a tightening up in that arena. Maybe you could share with us how that's going to happen. Maybe it's already happening.
Co-chairs, Representative Benz, one of the appeals of Senate Bill 863 for my company, I think for the coalition supporting this legislation, is that it does reopen a conversation with Oregon Housing and Community Services about how best to design these programs. They work. We think they work pretty good, but they could work better. For instance, Pacific Power in 2006-2007 completed an arrearage study. So we looked at customers who got behind in their bills. We looked at service disconnects in our system and came up with some pretty good data and some ideas on how to better manage these situations so that we're not having as many shutoffs and that we are able to design programs that get to customers sooner and better and more efficiently. Senate Bill 863 does reopen that conversation, does promote another look at how to redesign Oregon's system, and that's something we're very much interested in.
Thank you.
Other questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Berger.
Yes, I'd like to point out, because this is this discussion is useful and interesting, and on page 6 of the bill, and I'm not sure what section, but the sub D, it says it actually requires some reporting of real actual data that will be very useful going forward as to the how this impacts and will, I think, give us an update and better data going forward than the 03 study, and I'm very encouraged by that information in the bill. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
If I may just...
Yes, please.
To emphasize that point, while the temporary funding assistance is, as we've talked about, sunsetted after 2 years, this language, which will improve the reporting and allow us to sort of build a better mousetrap, if you will, this is permanent language, and so this will remain so that we can continue to improve these programs and have better input from all the partners.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Jeff Bissonnette?
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers, also here in support of the bill. I think a couple things to hit on. One is we're supportive of the bill because this really is a system cost, and the more that we can keep folks attached to their electricity service without having them cut off, then reattached, then cut off, then reconnected, is is saves costs overall. It was one concern we had, frankly, going into the bill, that this is a slight change in policy in that where the rest of the program is kind of shared across customer classes, residential, commercial, and industrial. This is only on residential. And we were a little bit concerned about that, and it was the temporary nature that, you know, we thought, you know, we recognize the need, and so for the temporary two-year period, we could supplement the existing program. We thought that was a good compromise. Part of that compromise is the discussion that we just had is better reporting from Department of Housing and Community Services on the results of the existing program and how we can do it better, and to sort of go just a little bit more into the discussion that the committee was just having. The federal funds, which are going to see very likely a very sharp decrease, and that is going to have real impact in, you know, Oregon homes all across the state, and again, another reason to support this bill, have been going on for a long time. This particular program was first started back in 1999.
And if you could limit your remarks to the things that are really critical about this bill, that would be helpful.
Sir.
We have other matters to deal with this morning.
Absolutely.
Thank
Good
you.
Bill should pass.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Questions for Mr. Bissonnette? Thank you. We appreciate
Thank you.
Your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on Senate Bill 863? I don't see anyone. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 863 and open a work session on Senate Bill 863. Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 863A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 863A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be supporting this bill, but I wanted to state very clearly why. I believe right now we are in a unique time in our economic history. The downturn has gone on longer than most of us expected and clearly more than all of us wanted. In my particular district, there's a high need. I don't think my district is unique for this. We have utility companies that are often left holding the financial bag with bad debts. Yet they're providing the services and don't know till after the services are provided that that they will not be able to collect on them. And yet those who can pay for things in this economy, those of us fortunate to have income or jobs or any type of financial means, we keep having to underwrite for folks that are harmed by this economy. But it is a bad situation. The qualifications to be helped by this program are stringent. And it is only crisis assistance. I don't believe that this program is creating a dependency, and it is for folks in need. So because the bad debts would be otherwise included in the next rate case and thus resulting in higher rates to the ratepayers anyway, I can support this bill, stop the misery and bleeding to our Oregon families who happen to be in crisis in need of this program. And I believe it's the right decision, since inevitably the bad debts will be paid by the ratepayers anyway. I think it's the right thing to do preventatively, help our families who need it.
Thank you, Representative Brewer. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be supporting the bill as well, and I want to thank the coalition of folks who are here, particularly the utilities. I agree strongly with the observations about the connections between energy and the economy. I think that connection is likely to continue and perhaps even to increase with the cost of energy. I think that's why it's really important for us to do all we can about our own energy security and independence. Some of you know that's one of the reasons I've been working on ways to find better methods of operation and funding for energy research and development. We haven't addressed that this session to the degree that I would like, but you can bet that I'll be continuing to work on that. I hope we'll have the collaboration of the stakeholders that are here today and others.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll be supporting the bill also, although primarily because the companies have indicated that this is a means of making the situation better for all ratepayers. It strikes me that this is not quite the right way to be accomplishing that which we're trying to accomplish, but maybe, as we heard, is the only way. And finally, because indeed the data gathering is important. So for those reasons, I'll support the bill.
Thank you. And I agree that actually gathering data as things go along and be able to summarize and report it will give us a good deal of useful information about how we ought to proceed in the future. Any other discussion? Is there any objection to the bill going to the floor with a due pass? I don't see any, so that motion is carried. Would Representative Kotek like to carry? I get a head nod. Representative Kotek will carry the bill. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 863, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 984. Day.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Senate Bill 984 makes a couple of changes in managing of local government unemployment trust fund. Excuse me for my voice. I'm suffering from sinus infection at this point. Under this bill, actually, a local government employer is allowed to work with the Oregon Employment Department so that it does not overpay into its government unemployment compensation trust fund and seek an extended payment plan in replenishing insufficient account balance.
Thank you. Yes, good morning, Senator Starr.
Good morning. For the record, it's Senator Bruce Starr representing Western Washington County and the great town of North Plains. And it's North Plains that brings us here this morning in Senate Bill 984, and I appreciate you hearing and working on this important bill. This bill came about because I got a phone call from Mr. Don Otterman, who's sitting next to me, the city manager of North Plains, who was facing a challenge, and the challenge was their unemployment charge back to the employment department went from a small amount to a very, very large amount in one year period of time. Senate Bill 984, quite frankly, provides the city of North Plains and other like small cities the opportunity, instead of having to repay this local government benefit trust fund in a 12-month period, allows them to stretch those payments out over to 3 years, and that basically allows for a cash flow situation that doesn't have huge impacts on small cities like North Plains. In a nutshell, that's the reason that we're here today. It's not, a huge problem that we're trying to fix, except if you're a small city and you happen to have all of a sudden this huge bill kind of land on your doorstep. And Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to testify and support this bill and ask that you would allow my colleague on my left an opportunity to speak, but also then hear the experience of North Plains. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sean Lindsay, representing House District 30, which is also represents North Plains. I hope to continue representing North Plains as well. If you haven't been out to North Plains, in August they have the North Plains Garlic Festival. It's a great place. I was also out there just a few weeks ago visiting with the city council, and we met in a room smaller than this, which is the city council room, and it's about 2,000 to 2,500 members or community members. And the bottom line is that I support this bill because it's truly a cash flow issue. Bigger municipalities and cities can absorb these amounts of money, but the smaller communities just can't handle this issue. It's a cash flow issue. This is a way to help these smaller communities. I hope, urge your aye vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart and Chair Berger and members of the committee, my name is Don Otterman, City Manager, City of North Plains. Senator Starr summarized the bill very, very eloquently. What I will do is just explain the impact on the City of North Plains. Our unemployment costs for the current fiscal year are $3,162. That's for a city with 12 full-time and 5 part-time employees. So $3,162 for the year. We've been very good as far as not having to have situations with with former employees collecting unemployment. We ran into a situation, unfortunately, not too long ago where that changed, and there were some employees that unfortunately did have to collect unemployment. Our reserve account, we were notified by the employment department, had a negative balance. And we were notified that based upon state law, which requires that if you have a negative balance, that your balance be repaid within a period of 1 year, we were faced with a special assessment in the next fiscal year of $12,160. In addition to that, they also notified us that our unemployment rate for the next year, our assessment for the next year, was going from $3,162 to $39,184. So we're looking at a special assessment and our unemployment assessment totaling $54,000 for the next fiscal year. That there's two issues with that. One, of course, is that if you have a negative balance, you have to repay the negative balance within a period of a year. This bill would change that so that a local government could request that they be allowed up to 3 years to repay the negative balance. And the second thing is that it would allow a city, a member of the pool, to request during the fiscal year that the employment division recalculate the assessment to determine whether or not possibly the assessment could be reduced based upon the history of the city and our history with, you know, with the unemployment compensation. What will happen this year with us is that we under current law, we will have to pay the $39,000 assessment, and at the end of the fiscal year, we probably will receive a rebate of some of that money because our account will then have too much money in it. And so rather than being faced with a situation like this, what this bill would do would be to allow cities that are in a situation like this to be able to request during the year that the employment department recalculate their assessment to determine whether or not we would be paying or that city would be paying too much in the way of an assessment. And they could adjust the assessment during the fiscal year. So those are the two reasons why North Plains is in favor of this bill. And as you can see, with a city of 12 employees, an increase of $51,000 in our unemployment cost is a substantial hit on a city our size. When our general fund budget is about $1.6 million, so $54,000 is quite an extensive hit on our budget. So that's all the information I'd like to provide to you. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer. Thank you.
And I will note, colleagues, that we have the Employment Department yet to come. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Edwards? Mr. Winkles? Good morning.
Morning. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Rob Edwards. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Division of the Employment Department. And Mr. Ottoman and Senator and Representative actually covered the situation pretty well. The department is in favor of the bill. We have no problems with it. Basically, what we want to do is try and prevent a situation, as Mr. Ottoman described, where a local government overpays their reserve account and turns around and has to be refunded the money in the following fiscal year. the situation that you heard Mr. Otterman describe basically happens when there's an anomalous unemployment insurance claim that's not in line with their previous history. If they have a history where they've had few claims, this would never happen. But if they happen to have a claim that goes on for a long time and a lot of money is paid out of their reserve account, they can come into this negative balance situation and have to repay the money over, under current law, 12 months. Under the proposed change, it would be 3 years. Other than that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Please.
For the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in support of Senate Bill 984, and I'd like to open by thanking Senator Starr and Representative Lindsey for introducing this legislation past the deadline, and it has been a flurry of activity to get it moving at this stage of the session. I would simply like to point out a couple of things about the bill. One, while the great city of North Plains is experiencing this issue, they are not unique in the state. We have heard some rumblings from other members that they are, they may be experiencing or anticipate experiencing a similar situation. And I would also add that, cities are going to get out of this recession and out of the downturn more slowly than other, than the private sector and other businesses. That's just sort of the way it works. So even while the economy may be improving, and I hope the last jobs report was just a blip and we'll be back on track, I think we can anticipate cities and other local governments experiencing economic pain for quite a bit longer than other sectors of the economy. So we do anticipate that this situation may repeat itself without this legislation. And with that, I'm eager for your questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Chair. Is there a shift of risk or a shift of cost by virtue of the change? By risk, I mean the extended period of time over which the repayment is allowed, and cost, I mean the interest cost of carrying the party you're waiting to be paid by.
Co-chairs, Representative Vance, we submitted a fiscal impact showing no revenue impact. There will be a slight loss of interest to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund because of the extended repayment plan, but it will be very minimal.
Co-chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, I'd also point out that Washington State also has a three-year repayment time window, and that is not, in this my understanding, that is not at the request of the agency. That's just the standard repayment schedule.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
It's one thing, I suppose, when the amount is $50,000. It's another when it might be significantly more. Do you anticipate there being situations where we're looking at something in the millions as opposed to thousands?
Co-chairs, Representative Benz, that's an excellent question. Currently, there are 277 participants in the program. Most of them are small cities. There are a few counties. There are a lot of small special districts that are in the program. So, no, we do not anticipate a large participant such as a county getting into the situation.
Yes. Well, thank you, Mr. I guess whenever you see the word trust fund, it's obvious. It's important that the money be there. And so this change, in your opinion, would not allow anyone to game the system. That is, because if I could see a way of not having to pay and then use somebody else's money for all these quarters, I would be tempted. So my question is the department still in position to prevent that from happening?
Co-chairs, Representative Benz, yes, my opinion is that we are still in a position to do that, and that these changes would not allow anybody to game the system any more than is already possible.
That's reassuring.
Mr. Chairman, that just tempted me to ask a follow-up. So,
Go ahead. I thought you might.
So are you saying it can be gamed now, or are you saying that we should make some other change? Or I guess I didn't know what you're saying.
Co-chairs, Representative Benz, I apologize for not being clear. No, there is no gaming in the local government employers benefit trust fund system that I am aware of. I use that cautionary phrase because I can't anticipate what might be possible by somebody. But no, there's no evidence of that at all at the moment.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you. I
like this bill, and I definitely understand the need with North Plains, just as much as north of my district, and it is, by the way, a very good city. I urge you to go there, spend your money. But one of the things that my concern is with the bill in general is the broad application of it. I've been very concerned with different government municipalities having unfunded liabilities, and this, in fact, allows an exacerbation of it bleeding over the debt balance to 3 years. So my concern is that what I would prefer, like, and I know that it won't happen in this session with this bill, if particularly if we move it out now, that there aren't some scenario triggers in here, unless I overlook them. I would like to see some scenario, some triggers that cause a municipality, that permit a municipality to extend the repayment period to 3 years versus an outright 3-year ability to restore. Did I miss that in this bill, or are there, in fact, any triggers in this bill?
Co-chairs, Representative Brewer, I believe that the bill says that the municipality can request an extension, but the director does have the discretion to deny that extension to 3 years. So it could remain 12 months if the director thought there was a good reason to do that.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on Senate Bill 984? Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 984, open a work session on Senate Bill 984. Representative Berger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 984 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 984 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? I don't see any. Motion carries. We'll ask Representative Lindsay to carry the bill. If he won't, we'll discuss that at that time. I suspect he will. So that will close the work session on Senate Bill 984.
Could we have a recess?
Yeah, let's stand at ease.
Committee will come back to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3374. And colleagues, it's my intention to recess or to adjourn by no later than 9:45, if we can manage that. Please, go ahead, give us the summary.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, House Bill 3374 would establish an excise tax of 5 cents per pound on wild bird feed. There is a dash one amendment before you that just deals with some of the technical details of the way that the excise tax is actually implemented. Rather than coming from a wholesale distributor, it would come from anyone who initially distributes the seed in the state. There is an exemption in here for seed that's part of commercial feed. Additionally, the Dash 1 amendment adds a section that the Department of Fish and Wildlife would establish and maintain a full-time equivalent conservation coordinator position, avian conservation coordinator position within the state Department of Fish and Wildlife. And this bill actually puts the funds into a wild bird conservation fund in the state treasury. And I had worked on some Alfred Hitchcock references or something like that, but I decided that maybe I would just wing it.
I can tell that Mazen Malik has been a very bad influence on you. All right. Where is Steve?
He's not even on Sue Marshall, I think.
Okay, there. Well, Sue Marshall, Warren, looks like Allie, perhaps, and Doreen, I'm not sure the last name. Baytot, thank you.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing Audubon Society, Tualatin, and Willamette Riverkeepers on this bill. I work very closely with a coalition of folks, and I thought I would just give you a brief of the mechanics of the bill, let others fill in the detail and background. The Dash 1 amendment is what I'll speak to. The bill would have a 5 cent per pound excise tax on wild bird feed collected from the initial distributor that first distributes wild bird feed into the state. This was important to close any loopholes and capture everyone that would be selling wild bird feed, so that's a level playing field. Oregon Department of Agriculture is tasked with collecting the tax. They have an existing relationship with the wild bird feed industry. They're currently administering a consumer protection program related to possible contamination with weed seeds, so we felt this was the lowest cost admin way to go. After ODA covers their administrative and potential enforcement costs, the remainder of the funds will be transferred to the Wild Bird Conservation Fund. This would be administered by ODFW to support wild bird conservation efforts that are consistent with the Oregon conservation strategy. We've worked very closely with both agencies in developing the specific language of this bill. We anticipate that the nickel for birds would raise $2 to $4 million per biennium. We have a commitment from ODFW to work with an advisory group on the utilization of these funds. The bill sunsets in 2020. This would provide the legislature an opportunity to revisit this, evaluate it, make any changes, or eliminate it altogether. So others will elaborate on the program. I'm happy to answer any questions, and both agencies are here as well.
Thank you. And I do appreciate your being brief. That we have 21 people signed up and about less than half an hour to hear them. So please go ahead.
My name is Co-Chair Berger and Barnhart. My name is Warren Aney, and I need a microphone.
Not too close.
Okay.
I'm a resident of Tigard, Oregon. I'm background in fish and wildlife management, research, administration, and environmental assessment, and I'm part of the team that put this concept together. I want to give you a little bit of a background on how we do pay for fish and wildlife in Oregon. About 70 or 80 years ago, the state fish and game programs were supported by hunting and angling regulations, and also some state funds. And then in 37, Congress enacted the Federal Aid to Wildlife Restoration Act, Pittman-Robertson Act, 11% excise tax on sporting arms and ammunition collected at the manufacturer level. And these are apportioned to states for wildlife habitat improvement, habitat conservation, research, hunter education. And this concept got wide support from the industry and from the hunters. In 1950, it did the same thing on the fish end of it. Let me get caught up with my slideshow here. There we are. The Dingell-Johnson Act was 10% on fishing tackle, and again, it went to state fish and game fish programs, aquatic education, boat safety, things like that. And it also got wide support from industry and from the anglers. And these federal taxes now provide about $600 million a year nationwide. Oregon gets about $13 million a year for these programs. So it requires state matching at a ratio of 1-3. Since the 1930s, angling and hunting license fees have been dedicated to fish and wildlife conservation relating to hunting and species that are hunted and angled for. And in the 1980s, that was made a policy. So this is how basically the program is supported in the state. Let's take a look at what goes on in the state. About 300,000 hunt in Oregon, 600,000 fish, about 1.7 million engage in what we call wildlife viewing. Expenditures, contributions to the economy. It's significant, but the biggie there is wildlife viewing. $1.0 billion a year contributed to the state economy by people who do wildlife viewing. And there is overlap among these groups, of course. So, you know, these are not three separate communities. These are overlapped communities.
Excuse me. This is money spent by private individuals, not money that the state spends.
That's absolutely right. This is money that they contribute to the state economy.
Thank you.
Lodging and accommodations and buying supplies and gear and stuff.
And Representative Berger would like to know what the source of the data is that you've been giving.
There was a survey that was conducted by the Department of Fish and Wildlife and I can't remember the other agency.
Pardon?
2006, there was a survey that...
ODF&W?
Yes, uh-huh. And this is also supported by a federal survey that's done periodically also. So if you look at the state conservation program support, how much do these people pay to directly support the programs that benefit the species they're interested in? Well, if you take the PR, Patton Robertson, and the DJ funds and the license and angler fees, you see that hunters are spending about $12.6 million. Let me say that again. Hunters and anglers are spending a total of about $12.6 million that comes from these excise taxes and another $49 million that's license and tag fees, wildlife viewers zero to the state of Portland. So we wanted to correct that. It's an equity issue. And several states do have some good programs where the general public is able to contribute to these. State tax checkoff in Minnesota, for example, is similar to the one in Oregon, except theirs generates a lot more money. They also have a lottery ticket sales tax and a recent addition to their state sales tax. Arkansas, again, a sales tax and a real estate transfer tax. And some other states, you're talking about real estate transfer tax, share of state lottery proceeds, special license plate fees, and even a couple of states have an outdoor equipment sales tax that goes to support fish and wildlife management. We mentioned the Oregon Conservation Strategy. It's a comprehensive statewide strategy. It's one of the best in the nation. It's being used by the by agencies and by resource managers around the state, but it needs funding. It needs implementation in a more broad perspective. And we've been working then to try to come up with way. Here's what the Oregon Conservation Strategy does. It provides for public and private partnerships, on-the-ground action, and so on and so on. We've had a wildlife funding team that's been working on this since 2008, and our goal is to fully implement the Oregon Conservation Strategy, or at least partially implement it. About 30 organizations, and you can see the list here of some of the members of that funding team. And how much revenue would be generated? Well, as Holly already said, it'd be a 5 cent per pound fee, which would raise retail prices about 3 to 6%, according to our work with survey and retail shelf prices and talking to the Department of Agriculture, and would generate as much as $2 million per year. And these would be used to implement, that sounds better, aspects of the Oregon Conservation Strategy, particularly those we're looking at that are wildlife viewing species and their habitats. This would benefit native songbirds and other strategy species, involve a diversity of people and organizations, and promote nature-based activities. Well, anyway, there's a summary on the statistics on the economics if you're interested. This has received real wide press support, but enthusiastic press support from East Oregonian, from the Oregonian, from Portland Tribune, and that kind of ends my little spiel on what I think is a good idea. Are there any questions?
Good morning, Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, and members of the committee. My name is Darlene Baytot, and I'm here as a representative of Backyard Bird Shop. Scott Lukens, our owner, is not able to be here because he is out with birders raising funds for Audubon Society of Portland's programs out in eastern Oregon, spending money, putting money into the local communities there. And so I would like to go ahead and read his testimony. I'm here. He's asked me to be here to do this for him. My name is Scott Lukens, and I have asked Darlene Baytot to deliver my testimony on HB 3374. I'm not able to be present for the public hearings as I'm in eastern Oregon with a group of birders, raising money to support the programs of Portland Audubon Society. As a small business owner and passionate wildlife enthusiast, I strongly support and believe in the merits of HB 3374. My business, Backyard Bird Shop, is an independent, Oregon-based chain of retail stores catering to hobbyists who love and feed wild birds in their backyards. Birdseed sales are about 50% of annual sales, and our Portland stores sell over 1.5 million pounds of birdseed annually. I'll repeat that. 1.5 million pounds of birdseed annually. As you might imagine, I do not take lightly anything that would raise prices and potentially impact sales and profits. It is clear, however, that something must be done to reverse the decline of our native songbirds. The risk of further declines is real, it has been documented, and we cannot afford the risk. Over the past month, I've taken time from my business to come to Salem and visit with House members on this subject. I know there is concern for any new tax and how it might impact citizens. I can tell you that I have talked with customers who have called me with the very same concern. The truth is that when these customers are presented with the data on decline and how their tax dollars would be used, they support the tax. They too want to help reverse the decline that has been documented with science. Please seriously consider sending this bill to the floor for a vote. Now is the time. Thank you, Scott Lukens. As store manager, I'd like to add that I've had numerous customers come in and say, I understand that you are supporting a bill that will put a tax on seed, and we are so grateful to you, and we think that's great. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. We have a number of other people to be heard from this morning. So if we've already heard the testimony, please don't repeat it. And we'll hear from Bob Salinger, Tony DeFalco, Tom Wolf. Tony's left. Then how about Joel? It looks like G-E-I-R. Not sure how to pronounce it. Please go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for the Portland Audubon Society. And we are here this morning to strongly support HB 3374. We've been working on this since its inception. And I know there are many people in the audience today. They're also in the overflow room who aren't going to testify, but I just wanted to point out that they are here. They've come down on their own accord, and they also are here to support this bill. We have put this bill out to our membership many, many times in our newsletter, through email alerts, through action alerts. We've asked them for their opinion on it because we have 11,000. My boss is in the audience today, right, reminded me it's actually 12,000 now members. This obviously is going to affect them directly. And so we wanted to hear back from them. And what we've heard is overwhelming support. They want to know the money's going to be used wisely. When they heard how it's going to be used, they supported it. I'd also note that we have a nature store at Audubon, and one of our primary revenue sources is bird seed. So we have a vested interest in this. If we didn't think it was going to go over well with our membership and the public, it would directly affect our conservation programs, our sanctuaries, and our education programs. I know this is a tax, but I think it's a different sort of tax. We've seen lots of taxes where people come in and say, tax them. You know, put a sin tax on cigarettes or beer or whatever. This is different because we're coming in and saying, tax us. We want to step up. We think it's the right thing to do, the fair thing to do. We've seen our friends in the hunting and fishing community do this for years. We want to be part of that as well. These are some of the common birds that you may have seen in your backyard. We have a rufous hummingbird, western bluebird, swallows, grosbeaks. These birds have something else in common. They've all seen more than 40% declines over the last 40 years, and that's based on U.S. Fish and Wildlife reports, American Bird Conservancy, National Audubon, and also some ODF&W reports. In fact, one out of every four species in Oregon is seeing major long-term declines. When we think of declining bird species, we tend to think of spotted owls and marbled murrelets, but it's actually many of our common backyard birds. They may be common now. They won't be common for long if trends continue. A couple of examples up close. Western meadowlark, our state bird, has virtually disappeared from western Oregon, something that our parents and our generation would have seen. Our kids are not going to see it. They're not going to see our state bird. It's being lost because of habitat loss. Streaked turnlark, not a very common bird, but a candidate species for the Endangered Species Act. It's found often in industrial areas, could have a major impact on the economy if it is listed. This bill gives us a chance to get ahead of listings. We know that it's much more expensive and much more disruptive to save species after they're listed federally. This is a species that, with proactive funding and work, we could avoid listings and we could avoid the problems of the Endangered Species Act. One more example. Sage grouse, another iconic species of eastern Oregon, also a candidate for listing. This is the kind of species this money would go to help. One final picture, the California condor, a bird that's been lost from our skies. It's being raised at the Oregon Zoo today. This is a kind of inspirational thing, you know, the Native American thunderbird that we could return to our landscape, improving our economy and just, you know, just an amazing sight, something that we shouldn't have lost and that we need to get back. We have a great blueprint for moving forward in the Oregon conservation strategy. I won't belabor that, but it's been one of the most widely applauded strategies in the United States. It tells us what we need to do and where we need to do it and which species we need to focus on. That's how we're going to spend this money. This will benefit all segments of our community. From backyards to our great wild landscapes is something that everyone can participate in. There's an equity component here. It's getting the next generation involved and reminding us that we all have a role to play in the environment. So I'll end by saying that, you know, some people have asked, how can we do this during a recession? I would argue this is exactly the kind of thing we can't afford not to do during a recession. When people want to step up, contribute, and protect the things they care about, that's the kind of opportunity that we actually really need to take care of. And the hunters and fishermen did it during the Great Recession. We're trying to do it during this recession. We urge you to move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, committee members. My name is Tom Wolf. Chair, Bergen Council, Trident Limited. You have my testimony. I'm not going to belabor and go into it because we've got about 16, 17 people that are going to be limited to a minute behind me. So I'll just say that Trident Limited, as a cold water conservation, none of this money will be going towards cold water stuff, but it is very necessary. We urge that you support this bill because it is a way to help fund ODFW's mandate to protect non-game fish and wildlife. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir. And by the way, that's a great model for testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, and members of the committee. My name is Joel Geyer. I'm a self-employed consultant on radioactive waste disposal issues, but you probably don't want to hear about that. I'm here as a bird watcher and someone who enjoys looking at birds. That makes me one of more than 1.7 million Oregonians who like to get out and look at wildlife, according to recent surveys that have already been cited. I'm also born and raised on a farm, keenly interested in rural development issues. For those reasons, I've volunteered for 6 to 7 years on the Oregon Birding Trails Project, which has been sponsored by the Oregon Tourism Commission. I'm actually authorized by Todd Davidson with Oregon Tourism Commission to leave testimony, which I've provided as written testimony, expressing their strong support for this. You may know them as Travel Oregon also. And I've also included one of our products. I know you're hardworking legislators, but if you get a chance to get out of the Capitol, you can enjoy some of the birds around the Wild Valley with this. The goal of birding trails is to promote wildlife tourism that brings dollars to rural communities. Oregon's total wildlife revenue, you've already heard some of this, but the most recent estimate is $1.023 billion per year, according to a 2008 study. And $462 million of that goes for travel on trips of overnight trips or trips of more than 50 miles. In the mostly rural regions of central, eastern, and southern Oregon, travel for wildlife viewing is responsible for 9.2% of total travel revenues. That compares with 8.6% of hunting and fishing revenues, which we know is important to those communities. Birding accounted for the largest share of overnight trips for wildlife viewing in these regions, 633,000 trips per year. That's a lot. So there's more facts that we've provided, but beyond those, the mere economic benefit, I'm interested in bird habitat, and I just want to say to close, birders want to pay their share. We're tired of hearing that we don't pay our share. We want to pay it, and this bill is going to be a winner for both rural residents who will have their quality of life improved, as well as for bird watchers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony. And I'm going to mess up some of these names because I have trouble reading them. It looks like Joe Rolliter, Dave Wiley, Meg Ruby on deck. Following them, Ginny Ross, Marla Ray, and Alana McDonald.
Go ahead, Dave.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, members of the committee. My name is Dave Wiley. I live in Sublimity, Oregon. I'm a hunter, a fisherman, and a birder. In 2004 or 2005, I was representing Oregon Hunters Association on the Oregon Conservation Strategy Advisory Committee. So I know where I speak. I've already emailed you my testimony in somewhat detail, but I want to tell you that 5 cents a pound on the 50 pounds of bird seed that I buy a year is money well spent. The Oregon Conservation Strategy is targeted at non-game and wild birds, conservation, habitat conservation and restoration. And with 25% of our native species in decline, including the state bird, I think that it's time we step up to the plate. And I'm willing to step up to the plate.
Thank you. So we could call this the State Bird Recovery Bill.
Perhaps.
Okay, please.
Good morning. Thank you, co-chairs and committee members. My name is Meg Ruby. I'm here as a busy mom of two school-age boys, and I won't read my whole testimony, but I want to speak on behalf of them and on Oregon's next generation. Like thousands of other Oregonians, I buy bird seed, I buy suet, and I feed birds in my yard. And I do that because I love watching the birds and hearing them. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote, "'Tis always morning somewhere, and somewhere the birds are singing evermore." May that always be the case. Dr. Seuss wrote in A Less Happy Future in the book called The Lorax, at the far end of town where the grickle grass grows and no birds ever sing excepting old crows. I reference both of those because we have a choice right now. We can continue to host an amazing diversity of our bird life, or we can sit back and watch it decline. My family, we travel the whole state to be in nature, to view wildlife, to kayak, canoe, etc. We contribute to local economies, but we don't have a chance to support with fees for management and conservation the way anglers and hunters do. We would like to do that. My husband and I just sat down to budget, looking again for another way to make ends meet. But I know that we and my friends are all glad to pay a nickel for the birds. I hope we get a chance to do that. Our Oregon birds are our wildlife, are our natural heritage. We can conserve them or squander them. This committee right now could pass this bill out and give it a chance. It'll be the first step to an important victory. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. My wife and I own a small forest, highly managed forest, between Walport and Yahats. We actually feed about 50 pounds of wild bird seed a month. And frankly, the 5 cents a pound is a small fee to pay for the pleasure of seeing the birds. As you know, in my real life, I represent sports and commercial fishermen. And we pay ad valorem fees, license fees, and permit fees into the Department of Fish and Wildlife. But most of those fees are dedicated, and they have to be used for various purposes on the species that are being hunted and fished by us. We've been working for about 10 years on this wildlife strategy to try to figure out a way to take care of all the rest of the birds. We also have a nearshore strategy, which is the state waters part of the conservation strategy. And we've been looking for ways to fund this, and this is we think this is a good way to fund this. We hope that people who pay this fee will pay it willingly, and it'll give the Department of Fish and Wildlife another way to pay for some of these things they do for non-game wildlife. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Ginny Ross, Marla Ray, Alana McDonald on deck. Lynn Herring, Trey, Carl Scopes, thank you, and Bob Olson. Please, ladies, go ahead.
Good morning, co-chairs and committee members. Thank you for holding this hearing. My name is Virginia Ross, known as Ginny, and I reside in Portland, Oregon. I think you've heard very significant data this morning in the testimony. Not only in terms of revenue coming into our state from those who come here to visit our wildlife places, but also those of us who spend money going around the state trying to find these wonderful wildlife species that we have been talking about. You've also heard about the decline in the numbers of birds, and I'm here to say that I'm very disappointed when I watch during the day at my feeders and I don't see a Rufous hummingbird any longer. So I'm here as a lover of wildlife species asking you to support this House bill and this effort. It affords us a wonderful opportunity to restore habitat, educate the public, and expand programs that are currently underway to try and preserve these wild bird species. I'm not asking you to spread this cost to every Oregonian, only those of us who buy seed to feed the wild species that come into our backyards. I am more than willing to spend another 5 cents per pound for bird seed. And together we can make a difference. I would ask that you send this bill to the House with a due pass recommendation. And thank you for holding this hearing. And thank you for your service.
Thank you very much. Please.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, before I introduce myself, it's nice to have an economist with a sense of humor.
We have a broom over here.
Yes. My name's Marla Ray. I am days, if not hours, away from concluding my 9 years of volunteer service on the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission, and I am here to inform you that the commission itself has put a very, very heavy emphasis on the Oregon Conservation Strategy. You've heard that it's a nationally recognized conservation blueprint, and it represents a lot of work by a lot of people throughout the state. House Bill 3374, which the Department of Fish and Wildlife, by the way, supports, is a very creative way for those who enjoy Oregon's wildlife to help pay for and manage those wildlife and their habitats. It's a rare day indeed when an industry comes to you and asks that you levy a small excise tax on them. There is a very minimal administrative cost to the Department of Fish and Wildlife, yet huge benefits for the conservation strategy for native birds in recognition of the time and more passionate volunteers. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you.
I'm Alana McDonald and a member of Salem Audubon. But maybe more importantly, I'm a homeowner about 2 miles away. And I, when I moved here, bought a little tiny house with a very barren yard, no birds, no butterflies, no bees. And I've restored it to native wildlife habitat. And I now have about 50 birds a day. I even have an endangered bumblebee that's taken over one of my bird nests. And I think we all could do that. And, you know, I buy maybe 50 pounds, 100 pounds a year of bird feed. I'm happy to do it. And I also wanted to tell you, I just got back from Eastern Oregon, and I haven't lived in this state since I was 16, but I met 100 people from Europe, and five of them were in Diamond, and they were all bird watching. So it's important to the state.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir,
I'm
Representative
Berkley. Marla, I don't want to put you on the spot.
She
will.
But I'm going to. As I understand it, somebody earlier in the testimony mentioned ODF&W's mandate to protect non-game wildlife. Do you know what they were referring to?
Yes.
Would you explain it to me, please?
No.
Okay, somebody else will.
Yes.
The other question for that somebody else is, there's a bill and there's an amendment. The bill, I read language where it says it would fund a position within ODF&W. I don't know if that's in the amendment. So those are my two questions that are on the record for somebody to come to.
Got it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The
panel I already
called.
It's in
the amendment. My staff says it's in the amendment.
the panel I already called is a follow-up, and then after them, Lynn Leiby, Robin Blummel, and John Edwards in the on deck. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Co-Chair Barnhart and Berger. Thanks so much. Trey Karskaden, residing in Tualatin, representing the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association. And, it's fifth-generation Oregonian. One of the things I'm most proud of is the vision of the state. We come out, looking ahead, making changes that benefit this state. And I look at this measure as one of those visionary steps. This agency is largely supported on the backs of hunters and anglers, who I represent on the fishing side. Last session, we took a 20% fee increase on our license fees to support fishing and the fishing mission. Seems to me a 5 cent per pound tax is more than reasonable in helping relieve some of the burden that we carry in pushing the conservation mission forward. So I would urge your support. I know that in this, I'm generally not one to come in front of this body and ask for taxes. Fundamentally, they don't appeal to me at all. It certainly was a tough pill to swallow last session, but, in the whole scheme of things, this seems abundantly reasonable, and I would urge your support. And thank you very much for your service.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, committee members, Bob Olson for Northwest Steelheaders. It's not possible to add a whole lot to the good information that's been presented today, but I did want to go on record saying that we agree that it's important to have a broad public support for these important programs, and this is an important first step in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Good morning. My name is Lynn Herring, and I have submitted written testimony for the record, so I will be brief. I urge you to support House Bill 3374, the Wild Bird Conservation Act, a nickel for the birds. In a time of state budget challenge, I personally want to support the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife in its efforts to further wild bird and habitat conservation. As a lifelong naturalist and bird watcher, I enjoy watching, feeding, and studying our wonderful Oregon wild birds. Winter resident species like the very thrush, migratory species that may spend their breeding summers here like western tanagers, or just stop over to feed in the spring like the many colorful warblers or the shorebirds migrating through in the fall. I lead a Christmas bird count team each winter, a birdathon team each spring to count their numbers and thereby help gain new information on population trends. This bill presents an opportunity for bird lovers to contribute to the recovery of declining species before they become threatened or endangered. The legislation would allow those of us, the bird watchers and the bird lovers, to contribute this very small amount, an extra nickel per pound of bird seed, an amount that will make a big difference toward helping protect and restore wild bird populations. So it's easy. Please support this legislation.
Thank you very much. And questions for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. The panel I've already called, and then Merrill Redditch on deck. And is there anyone else who wants to be heard this morning that I haven't already named? Yes. I did call Jim, Robin, and John. So I see one of you here. Go ahead.
Hi, Jim Labby. I live at 6325 North Albina in Portland. My family has been enjoying the wildlife of Oregon for upward to 150 years in Oregon on either side, and including my great-grandfather, who was the first game commissioner, Hollister McGuire. And I'm here today to support House Bill 3374, the Wild Bird Conservation Act. I'll just say I'm a birder. My whole family is, and we have Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and others. And we actually really all support this. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
The House will be very pleased to hear that.
Okay, good.
All right. Is are Robin or John here? Perhaps they had to leave. Merrill Redditch, and then I'd also like to hear from the department. And there was a man over here who put his hand up. Would you come forward now, please?
Sure. I testified for Scott. Am I able to testify for myself?
Well, we're really out of time at this point.
I would be willing to give over my 1 minute for Darlene.
Okay, thank you. Please, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Chris Brindle. I own the Wild Birds Unlimited store here in Salem. I hate to be one of the only voices of disapproval of this, but at this point...
That's why we have a public hearing, so
right.
We can hear from both sides.
I kind of have a feeling that right now bird seed prices are going up. I've just had my third price increase in bird seeds, and I'm told bird seed will continue to go up this year because of weather conditions in places where it's grown. It is also a commodity, so it does, prices do fluctuate. When they say a nickel for the birds, that is a dollar a bag of bird seed for 20 pounds. And yeah, I know it doesn't seem like a lot, but for my small business, this last year we sold 226,000 pounds of bird seed. So not a lot compared to backyard bird shops, but this is only the Salem store of Wild Birds Unlimited, which is a national franchise, although we do own our own store, my wife and I. I just have a feeling that my customers aren't going to pay another $2 or more for a bag of bird seed, because inevitably my supplier will pass it on to me. I will have to pass it on to my customers, and I think a lot of my customers are people that do most of their bird watching and bird feeding in their backyards. And I think a lot of them that are not real serious bird feeders are, when the price goes up, they're going to stop feeding the birds, or they're going to go and buy, you know, the less expensive bird seed that birds don't generally really eat. So you got a lot more waste than you have problems with that. But I want to be convinced that this is it's a good bill. I would be for it, but at this point I don't hear anything that's making me say okay. So I would love to be for it. I just need to be convinced.
Thank you. Please.
Hi, my name is Darlene Baytot, and this time I want to speak on behalf of myself and on behalf of the birds. I've been interested in birds since I was 12 years old, and I've been feeding birds not just in Oregon, but in Oregon the last 20 years. And I've definitely seen a decline of birds, even though I've done stuff with my own backyard with native species. And I'm very concerned that if we don't move forward with some way of being able to fund the non-game species, that we are going to continue to see that decline. And nothing would be more sad to me than being responsible for saying, I'm not going to pay a dollar more, I'm not going to pay $2 more. For folks who are buying 50 pounds a year, it's a minimal amount. For folks paying for, let's say they get, like he said, every month he gets 50 pounds of seed. Usually you're budgeting according to what you can do, and that small amount is so trivial compared to what it's going to do for us and for the generations that we have coming up. So I would really like to urge you to pass that, and I appreciate your time and for letting me step in again.
Thank you very much. Question? Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. I haven't really heard from distributors, unless I've been mistaken, and both of you being retailers here, have you received any feedback from distributors? And also I'm wondering if someone can tell me the difference between wholesale distributor versus initial distributor.
I think Mr. Kafari is going to answer that one.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Stephen Kafari representing the Wildlife Society. I just wanted to answer the question about the distributors. We talked to some of the major distributors, Safeway and Fred Meyer's, and they had no problem with the bill.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm slightly confused. Fred Meyer and Safeway, I would think, would be retailers. So can
but
you
they
clarify?
Do their own distributing as well.
Following the supply chain from manufacturer down to retailer, distribution normally in there, outside of those retailers that do self-distribution, what is the difference between wholesale and initial distribution, and have you talked to other distributors outside of the retailers who also do their own distribution?
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, we have talked to other distributors. We talked to them when the bill was first introduced, and they are aware of the bill.
And when he says that, what he means is if they had a real problem, they'd come tell us. Please, go ahead.
Can you tell me
thank
the difference?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for allowing me for a follow-up. What's the difference between wholesale distribution and initial distribution? I'm confused by that.
Scott Lukens was going to answer that. Unfortunately, he's making money for the state of Oregon right now by taking a bunch of birders into eastern Oregon.
The Department of Ag answer that question.
Yeah, somebody else have to answer that question.
Thank
okay.
you.
Other questions for this panel?
I have a comment to make.
Yeah, yes, please. And while she's making her comment, unless it's about this panel.
Yes, it's on this
it
panel.
Is. Oh, please, go ahead.
Mr. Brindle happens to be the fellow that I buy my bird seed from. He probably isn't even aware of it.
Oh, yes, I am.
Right answer.
And I appreciate you coming forward and speaking on behalf of those of us who frequent your shop and are unaware when they walk in and say, your price has gone up, it's because of legislative action that they weren't aware of, and then they say, oh, well, I'm not going to go to Mr. Brindle's small shop anymore because I can get it cheaper at Home Depot, and it may not be as good as a product, and Mr. Brindle then is left struggling further in his competition with the big boxes and the big distributors. So I deeply appreciate you coming forward, sir, and speaking for my behalf, because I do buy a lot of birdseed at your shop.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions for the panel we just had? Why don't we excuse the two of you, ask the ODF&W to come forward, please.
Richard Tenike, the Oregon Department of Ag. I'm the feed specialist with the department, and I came to answer the question on initial versus wholesale.
Please, go ahead.
A wholesale distributor would be someone who resells the product to a retailer who's going to deal with the ultimate customer. The initial distributor in Oregon is a term we formed for this particular bill, and it would be the first seller of the product in Oregon. It could be a retailer. It could be a wholesaler. It could be a manufacturer. It could be a broker that's selling to a manufacturer. But we felt we needed to level the playing field all the way through the distribution system. We needed to catch the first person that sold it in the state, and that way every ton that passes through gets the fee placed on it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is that clear?
Is it fair to say you spent some time thinking about how to do this?
Yeah, we actually...
I don't need a big explanation, just I think yes is...
Yeah, we patterned it off of Washington, who does a similar thing for feed tonnage tax.
Great.
It's fairly common.
And then you had some questions for ODF&W.
I wanted to know about the ODF&W mandate to protect non-game wildlife, what that is, if it is, and where it is.
Absolutely. Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And what that's referring to, and I can give you the statutory citation, or I can read it to you, whichever is your preference.
It's the statutory.
It's ORS 496.012, and it's the state's wildlife policy. And it's fairly... 496.012.
And that dates from quite a
while.
Oh,
it goes back to 59, I believe.
And you do have a mandate to protect non-game mild within your organization.
Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, absolutely.
Thank you.
And I did want to say just a few words. We, for the department, we did not come here with written testimony today. We knew there was going to be a large number of folks signed up to testify. We wanted to defer to them. We think this is an excellent model. It's worked in the case of hunting and fishing activities. It's worked for 70 years. Those programs are strongly supported by those communities that pay the excise tax and support fish and wildlife conservation, at least as it relates to hunted and fished species. We certainly applaud these individuals for trying to broaden that concept to also include and capture some of the interest in non-game or non-hunted fish, non-hunted or fish species. We think it's a great step. You know, we normally come here and testify neutral on bills, but we're actually here testifying in support of this bill here today. And I do have Art Martin here as well. He can answer. You had some questions, I believe, about the position and any other specifics you have regarding our conservation strategy or this bill.
I think it's sufficient, you guys. There is a position in the amendment, and that's what I was asking.
Yeah. Right. I think for this morning, we have enough detail.
Okay.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you all very much. I would have not believed, what is it, 35 minutes ago that we would be able to actually get everybody to testify, and I appreciate your brevity and the depth of information that you've presented to us this morning in support of and in one case and opposed to the bill. The committee relies very heavily on information that the public brings us as we consider public policy, and we very much appreciate the time that you've spent this morning to come here and explain to us about the issues contained in this bill. Thank you very much. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3374. And colleagues, we're meeting for a short meeting tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. We have one matter
to
deal with. We're getting a photograph taken tomorrow morning for the committee and for JTAC, so be prepared. Then JTAC's committee meets at 8:30, so we have a full morning. With that, the committee's adjourned.